are we really open for business? We really want a gas line when we're not renewing a right-of-way for a gas line.
A permit refusal puts the All-Alaska Gas Line in question. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 17th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Denali climbing season registers its first death.
It didn't appear to be steep, steep terrain right where he fell, but as soon as he got out of control and gained speed, he could not recover.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has refused to extend a principal permit needed for construction of an all-Alaska gas pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez. The three-year construction permit was issued to Yukon Pacific in 1995 and has been extended four times since then. The project first began to come together during the Hammond administration and has been planned around liquefying the gas for shipment to overseas markets. Yukon Pacific's attorney, Washington, D.C.-based Patrick Rock, says Yukon Pacific has 30 days to appeal the denial, although a decision whether to request that appeal hasn't been made yet. Bill Walker of Valdez and a candidate for the Republican nomination for governor has been involved in the project from the beginning. He says the FERC decision is not a major setback at this point. He says it only affects the project's terminal at Anderson Bay, and supporters of the plan have known for a long time that the permit was needed to be updated.
What is important is the data that's been collected over the years to obtain this permit. I mean, some of these things took, you know, 5, 6, 7, or one took 8 years to obtain. So it's the data that's important that's been collected, and they have to update their plans for a facility based upon new technology. I don't think there's a problem with that at all. That sort of goes without saying that something that old is going to have to be updated, and we've always said that.
The letter of denial from FERC issued last Friday points to outdated measurements of air quality and marine vessel traffic, as well as old resource and cultural surveys that were used in the 1995 permit. It also cites new standards now in place that need to be addressed relating to safety and seismic technology that was not available for the original permit. The All-Alaska Gas Line is included in as an option in the current project now out for industry response from TransCanada. Although Yukon Pacific is not part of that plan, the permits and data have been discussed as a strong point for the Valdez route. Walker says more important than the FERC decision is the state's decision last year not to renew the state's right-of-way for the line.
The federal right-of-way was much longer, took 8 years to obtain, and so that's there, but you know, the state right away just sends a message that are we really open for business? We really want a gas line when we're not renewing a right of way for a gas line that companies spent years and years and years of work and data to obtain. I mean, what kind of a message is that?
The FERC notification points out that the decision does not have any direct bearing on consideration of Yukon Pacific's export option. It also makes no direct comment on the company's still valid export permit issued by the Department of Energy. A climber has died on Denali. The National Park Service reports that French mountaineer Pascal Frison was at the 12,000-foot level of the 20,000-foot peak when he fell yesterday. Park Public Information Officer Maureen McLaughlin says Frison and a climbing partner were in the area known as Motorcycle Hill. McLaughlin says Frison lost his footing when he grabbed for a gear sled that was sliding away.
It was probably one of those split-second, you know, reflexes where you see your sled starting to draw away from you and you know that all your equipment is in it and your just initial reaction is to stop that sled. And it, you know, it didn't appear to be steep, steep terrain right where he fell, but as soon as he got out of control and gained speed, he could not recover.
Frizon, who was not roped to his partner, fell about 1,500 feet and ended up in a crevasse. McLaughlin says the Park Service used a helicopter to lower a ranger into the crevasse, but he could not reach Frizon.
But based on the general lack of movement, his body position, and the observed results of the fall, he was able to determine that the climber was deceased.
The Park Service was assessing conditions today to determine if an attempt would be made to recover the body. McLaughlin says the fallen climber's partner made it safely off the mountain last night. She says the French mountaineers are very experienced and had also attempted Denali last summer. The fatal accident is the first this season on the mountain. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, polar explorers describe changes to the Arctic ice.
We were the last people to leave, and it was the 12th of May. So certainly expedition season is getting shorter and shorter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The number of Alaska Native students graduating from the University of Alaska Fairbanks has reached an all-time high. Nearly 1,200 students were to be recognized at commencement Sunday, and preliminary figures indicate 265 of the award recipients are Alaska Native or American Indian. Those figures include a spike in upper-level degrees. UAF data specialist Ian Olson says the 33 Native students receiving master's degrees are more than double the previous high, and he says the three doctoral degree recipients equal the total from the past decade. Mourners are gathered in Anchorage to pay tribute to former Alaska Governor and Nixon cabinet member Walter J. Hickel, 9 days after he died at age 90. APRN's Steve Heimel is outside the proceedings and describes the scene.
Well, Laurie, I'm standing in front of Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. It's a very large church here in Spinard, and the parking lot is completely full. All the streets in the entire neighborhood are full of vehicles, and there's just, I can only say, hordes of people who are coming to this funeral service for the late Governor Hickel. There's a lot of media press out front, and we see state trooper vehicles, and I guess just about every stretch limousine in town parked along the front of the church. Now, not only are they accommodating people inside this very large church, but also next door they have an annex where people can view the funeral mass that will probably go on for at least an hour. They can view it in there as well. So it appears that Alaskans feel very much that they've lost one of their own here, and they all want to show their respects. And of course, this will go on into the night. This a reception and people speaking into the microphone in front of a crowd at the Captain Cook Hotel, the governor's hotel. So it's still quite a large crowd building here, Laurie.
The burial is set for Tuesday. Hickel, who died May 8th, was Alaska's governor twice. Because of the funeral, all three members of Alaska's congressional delegation are in Anchorage. At noon, they spoke to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce on the impact of energy and environmental issues facing Alaska. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke first. The senior Republican member of the Senate's Energy and Resources Committee depicted an Alaskan economy under siege by Washington.
It's not so easy to just focus on one front. We're not just talking about whether or not ANWR becomes a wilderness area. We're not just talking about the threats that our oil and gas industry face. There are multiple fronts.
Murkowski attacked the Fish and Wildlife Service's study to determine if ANWR should become permanently set aside from any development, an action she described as a congressional prerogative. Murkowski, who has sought to restrict the Environmental Protection Agency's regulatory powers, cited EPA and the Fish and Wildlife Service's action against ConocoPhillips development plans because of concerns over river disruptions, EPA's increased restrictions over pre-existing lead paint, its proposed restrictions on lead in aviation fuel, and EPA's efforts to tighten ozone air standards. She's seeking Senate disapproval of the EPA and its power to regulate greenhouse gas sources. Senator Mark Begich was asked if he supported Murkowski's proposal. He described it as too narrow, saying what's needed is a total energy plan that includes greenhouse gas concerns. Begich says one of the biggest problems the Alaska delegation faces in Washington is that there is so little understanding of how Alaska is different, not only in development challenges, but in expertise. However, he says there are some glimmers of change.
You know, after years of delay by the Interior Department, Shell was able to receive its exploration plans for oil and gas development on Alaska Northern Coast. The EPA also granted the draft air permit for them to move forward. And following the tragic oil spill in the Gulf, Interior has asked Shell to reaffirm its safety procedures and equipment, which I think is prudent, and they're doing a good job in laying that out. But again, it's an effort to show that we can do this development the right way up here. We've done it. We've worked in extreme conditions and have had OCS for many years.
OCS stands for Outer Continental Shelf and is part of the mechanism for regulating offshore drilling. Congressman Don Young says the country needs to temper its immediate reaction to the Gulf Coast oil spill.
We ought to take the time to find out what happened and address that issue so it won't occur again. But 34% of our oil consumption comes from the Gulf of Mexico. 200,000 high-paying jobs are in the Gulf.
Young says offshore oil development needs to move forward in Alaska.
Is it fail-safe? No. I'll be the first one to tell you that. Is it safe? I believe it is.
As an added protection, Murkowski and Begich are co-sponsoring a liability fund increase.
Mark and I have introduced legislation that would bulk up the oil spill liability trust fund. There's $1.6 billion in the trust fund now that needs to be increased. We put in a measure that would raise, increase that to a $10 billion fund. We know that that money needs to be in there.
Other members of Congress say, given the extensive costs of the BP rig collapse and spill, the existing liability fund needs to be raised up to $70 billion. Murkowski told the chamber audience that would work against smaller domestic oil and gas developers wanting to operate in Alaska. Congressman Young also decried what he called inadequate science, creating endangered species rulings that impact Alaskan development.
I'm introducing the bill, now listen to this very closely, to take the polar bear off the threatened species list because their habitat has in fact increased. There's more habitat now in the last 54 years than ice has come back. They put it on because they lost the habitat. Now, it may not go anywhere, but it'll start the subject of talking about facts and science.
Young also spoke against the federal designation of the Cook Inlet beluga as endangered and the resulting costs incurred by the Port of Anchorage. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A team of British explorers just wrapped up a two-month trip in the Arctic, walking to the North Pole to collect samples to measure ocean acidification and ice thickness. Expedition leader Ann Daniels has been making trips to the Arctic since 1997. The team was dropped off on the Arctic sea ice and walked to the North Pole. Daniels says they experienced unparalleled and rapid ice movement.
This is the first time I've ever experienced such extensive drift southwards. And as we were walking northwards, the ice was continually taking us backwards, a little bit like walking the wrong way up an escalator. We were always being pulled in the opposite direction to that which we wanted to go.
Speaking from the Ottawa airport, where she was waiting for a plane back to the UK, Daniel says the ice was moving southerly at 6 miles in 24 hours, and they covered 500 nautical miles rather than the 268 they had envisioned. It meant they had to work longer hours to overcome the backwards drift.
And we were skiing and sledge hauling for 12 hours, having 3 hours sleep, and then getting back out and sledge hauling again for 12 hours. And it was only by doing the really long days that we managed to overcome the drift and actually get to the North Pole, where we made our final sampling, a hole at the pole, and took our last water samples and ice thickness measurements.
Daniel says one big difference in this expedition compared to 1997 was that the ice is much thinner.
But at times was only a few centimetres in thickness. And we were walking for days on this type of ice rather than multi-year ice or even ice that's sort of first-year ice. It was new ice a lot of the time.
She says they experienced ice cracking and splitting apart directly beneath a tent one night, and one day it rained, which was disturbing to them because it was an indication of spring breakup.
At one time, you could stay on expeditions till the end of May, even sometimes into the beginning of June, whereas now more and more expeditions are having to leave sort of early May, middle of May. We were the last people to leave, and it was the 12th of May. So certainly expedition season is getting shorter and shorter.
This is the first time samples have been collected there to test acidification levels. Daniel says British scientists will use the samples to develop baseline data. The test results are anticipated for September. The summer tourism season is underway at Denali National Park. Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says facilities in the park entrance area, including the visitors and wilderness access centers and sled dog kennel, opened over the weekend. Shuttle and tour buses begin operations Thursday, and campgrounds at Savage River, Igloo Creek, and Sanctuary River open this week. Pfister says park visitation is anticipated to rebound somewhat this summer after dipping last year.
Usually we've been a little over 400,000, and last year it was about 358,000. I know at least our mountaineering operations, the reservations for people wanting to climb the mountain are pretty much on the same par, but I've heard from local bed and breakfast owners that their reservations are actually up slightly.
Wildlife viewing is a primary draw for Denali visitors, but wolves may be harder to spot this summer. Pfister says sightings depend on where wolves den, but that overall, spring numbers were down from the 80 to 100 wolves normally counted by park biologists.
They counted 59 in the 12 packs that they documented during the spring surveys, and that's the lowest number since about the mid-80s, since we've been documenting the pack sizes. And so it's definitely on the low end right now.
Pfister says 13 wolves are missing from packs commonly seen along the park road, but they aren't sure how the animals died. She says the Park Service only knows of one collared pack wolf that was shot this winter, but that doesn't have winter harvest data from the state. Shooting and trapping of Denali wolves is expected to increase due to the State Game Board's recent elimination of the wolf buffer zone northeast of the park. Otna is partnering with a Canadian company to explore for minerals east of Glen Allen. The Regional Native Corporation for the Copper River Valley has signed an exploration agreement with Vancouver-based International Tower Hill. Otna Vice President of Lands and Resources, Catherine Martin, says the long-term deal with Tower Hill could result in development of a gold mine in the Chistochina area.
Basically, the exploration is 10 years, and if there's any significant find and, you know, something that's potentially mineable, that agreement will basically, the mining agreement, will, you know, will be for the production of gold.
Martin says Tower Hill is exploring about 75,000 acres of Otna property and 87,000 acres of adjacent state lands. The area has not seen previous exploratory work, but is near the historic Nabesna mining district. Martin says there's an existing access easement, but no road development is planned during exploration phase.
There is a 17B that goes back into that area, but they do not plan to develop that at this time, and they don't. It's all going to be aerial helicopter exploration. If roads are to be built, I would see that when a mine is developed.
Martin says aerial operations were scheduled to start over the weekend, with groundwork including drilling expected to begin June 1st. The exploration agreement with Tower Hill includes an Otna shareholder hire provision, $75,000 yearly payments to the Native Corporation, and $10,000 annual contributions to Otna Foundation scholarship programs.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
With the Deepwater Horizon well, oil well in the Gulf of Mexico continuing to spew hundreds of thousands of gallons of crude oil a day into the water, residents in coastal Louisiana are trying to prepare as best they can to save the marshlands that not only protect them from hurricanes, but provide vital breeding grounds for the rich variety of sea life much of the economy depends on. KMXT's Jay Barrett spoke with a former Kodiak resident who now lives in the path of the advancing oil slick.
After working as a school counselor for several years in Kodiak, Chuck Morris now lives with his family in Belle Chasse, Louisiana, just south of New Orleans and a few miles from the tip of the state, not far from the beaches and estuaries that are being threatened by the Deepwater Horizon blowout. He says knowing the oil slick is just offshore is causing a lot of tension, and the waiting is difficult.
That's probably the hardest thing about it, Jay, is, we get the reports that it's bad and it's getting worse, but it's taken a long time to get to the shore. And we have different kinds of shoreline. We have sandy beaches, which it wouldn't be so bad for that, but when it gets behind the sandy beaches, it'll get into estuary areas where there's a lot of marsh grass, and it's pretty fragile stuff.
He said the marshlands are vital to the state and its residents for many reasons.
Of course, it's related to seafood production, but it's also related to safety for all the communities that live just on the land side of the marsh, because that's our hurricane protection. So you get both the safety issues and also the seafood. It would be hell to live without seafood. Not to be able to have a crab oil, or something like that, that'd be awful.
Morris said hurricane season starts in 2 weeks on June 1st, but storms usually come later in the summer. Venice, Louisiana, at the southern tip of the state, is one of the largest fishing ports in the nation.
The statistics I've seen puts Dutch Harbor number one and Venice number two for fish on the dock. And the commercial fishermen fish all kind of stuff, crab and shrimp and different fin fish. Probably the most valuable is the shrimp.
Morris praised the Coast Guard for its rescue of the survivors of the Deepwater Horizon platform's explosion and collapse, and said there's a lot of National Guard presence since the blowout occurred, but he's also seen a lot of locals taking responsibility for trying to protect the shoreline themselves.
The most hopeful thing are the local people who are willing to do what it takes to boom the whole area. We have parishes, not boroughs, but the parish president said he's going to make a continuous boom from one side of the parish all the way across to the other side of the parish to try to keep it out of the estuaries. That's hopeful. Part of the problem, though, is they're trying to get boom from everywhere. I heard the governor the other day talk about requesting boom from all over the world. Now, I also saw a couple weeks ago we had some bad weather, some gale force winds, and the boom just gets all tied up. I saw some pictures of, big tangled messes on the beach. So the bad weather makes things worse as far as booming goes.
Morris said not knowing how much oil will have to be dealt with is another factor causing concern for residents, not just of Louisiana, but the entire Gulf of Mexico coast. The blowout has yet to be capped and is releasing at least 300,000 gallons of oil per day, with some estimates many times higher. It's expected to be a larger spill than the Exxon Valdez that dumped 11 million gallons of crude into Prince William Sound, which eventually found its way to Kodiak and beyond, devastating fisheries wherever it went. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
After 25 years of being a crab festival fixture, the annual frog jumping contest in Kodiak has been canceled. State Fish and Game officials are concerned the frogs, which are imported from the lower 48, might carry diseases which could be transferred to local fish stocks. Patty Allmeter is the manager of Tony's Bar, which sponsors the races.
And their concern is that if these frogs are brought in with these diseases, that they can be passed to Alaska's fish resources through, you know, they're saying, well, they could, people could walk out with these fungus and viruses on their shoes and somehow pass them to our fish resources, which would be, you know, a huge issue.
Allmeter says that even though the two diseases have not been reported in Alaska, she understands the need to protect Kodiak's fish. She says the cost of testing at $10 per frog is prohibitive, and so she decided to cancel the event. Bob Pierkowski runs the Fish Resource Permit Program for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that regulates the importation of outside species into the state for research purposes.
We understand that it's been a long process, and the Department of Fish and Game tries to work with folks, but any frogs that come into the state must have a fish resource permit, and the activity must be for scientific or educational purposes, but it doesn't meet the criteria.
The two pathogens that wild frogs, such as those used in frog jumping races, could wreak havoc with Alaska fish stocks. Pierkowski says chytrid fungus is the cause of so many deformities found in frogs around the world, while the rhinovirus has been known to jump species and infect fish.
The rhinovirus is a pretty nasty pathogen. Its genetic code is such that it's very adaptable. And again, it has jumped from fish to amphibians to turtles and snakes and then back to amphibians and fish. So if you look at the literature, it's gone to a number of different fish. So this is something that we don't even want to take a chance on.
Allmeter says she suggested several ways to mitigate the potential transfer of pathogens from the frogs to the world outside, such as forcing sponsors who handle the frogs to wash their hands, but the state wouldn't budge. Suggestions to replace the frogs with native species, such as slugs or crabs, have been suggested. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.